Tired of all the bugs in your yard? Enjoy your backyard again with Cutter Backyard Ready to Spray Bug Control at Menards. It kills mosquitoes, fleas, ticks, and other insects fast, controlling them for up to 12 weeks. A 32-ounce Ready to Spray container covers up to 5,000 square feet and is on sale now through July 13th. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week.
Save big money at Menards.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Gray Malkin Lane Patreon, where queer friends and allies gather to talk about obscure and often overlooked characters in the Marvel Universe. Today, I get to sit in awe with two of my very favorite people and very favorite writers. Annie Nesenti, who I have had on the show a couple of times, was probably the most influential writer in my youth, and Anthony Oliveira, my current favorite comics writer, I think. Just a joy to have you both here. We're going to talk all about Blackheart, the son of the devil today, which I'm very excited about. This is a character that I love. I did write the profile for this guy in the handbooks and on the appendix. This is a character that I am familiar with and that both of you have had your hands in, obviously at different points in his history. Let me have you both introduce yourselves. Tell us a little about yourselves, if you'd like, with your name and pronouns. And I'd love to hear your initial thoughts on what you love about Blackheart or about each other, because you're both amazing. Let's begin with Annie Nesenti. Annie, welcome back to Gray Malkin Lane.
Hi, thanks for having me. My name is Annie Nesenti, and I've been writing for Marvel Comics for, I hate to say it, 40 years. And now I'm focusing on these two babies behind me. If this is radio, not live, then
yeah, this is audio only.
Audio only. Then you don't know what I'm pointing to, but I'm pointing to my books with Karen Berger. I did two graphic novels, The Seeds and Ruby Falls, and now I'm working on my third graphic novel with the masterful Karen Berger.
That's phenomenal. I've read The Seeds. I have not read the other yet, and I need to. I'm thrilled. How wonderful.
Queer-friendly girl couple by Ooh. Flavia Biondi, who is basically resourcing her own relationship. So really fun. Three generations of women. And drawn by a woman, edited by a woman. So it's a girl book.
How wonderful. And let me also welcome the incredible Anthony Oliveira. Hi, Anthony.
Hi, how's it going?
Oh, good.
I'm Anthony Oliveira. Any pronouns are fine. I'm a writer. I'm in the middle of Avengers Academy, where we just brought Blackheart onto the scene. So this is, it's wonderful to be able to pick Anna Senti's brain about this, but also I'm such a huge fan. This is a real moment for me. I grew up reading your stuff. I had the novelizations you wrote, the like short story. I remember distinctly a moment where Peter Parker is looking in the mirror in a short story anthology you were part of. I think it's a Typhoid Mary story, but I was like, it was so definitive for me because it's like this moment where we think about how hot Peter Parker is. And like that to me is really one of the things I love so much about your work is the way that like... there's a horniness and there's like a male beauty thing that really interests me and I'm really interested in bringing back to comics. So this is a real highlight of my life right now.
It's an interesting thing to say because, you know, comics are, you know, especially in the 90s when they became like, I don't know, almost like they had a little too much porn.
Yes.
For me, you know, it was... But women have always been, of course, very sexy in comics. And I was thinking about this recently when I did an Angel story. Didn't we talk about Angel, Chad?
Your giant size X-Men. Yeah.
And it was sort of like, you know, I kind of wanted to deal with just like the gorgeousness of Angel, which I had done before with a story with David Mazzucchelli, that if he doesn't open his mouth... He's really sexy.
It's really, I think, one of the things that, I mean, as you say, the 90s were such like a ultra violent, like men are kind of like rough beasts in it. And your work always stops to think about like Daredevil, how hot Matt Murdock is. And like, I mean, part of it is also that you're working with Romita on these books and it like nothing looks like that. So
He's
I'm
a
trying to
nut.
bring a little bit of that horniness back to the PG
Yeah, bring back the horniness, you
crowd.
know? Not the rapiness of the 90s, the
Exactly.
horniness.
I have a moment on my show where I had Simon Furman on, and then I brought him back for a character episode on the character Wire from Alpha Flight, just like this. And in my email, I was like, Simon, if you reread these comics, they are so horny and so queer. And when he comes on the show, he's like, I had no idea what you were talking about until I reread them. There's so many naked men wrestling. It's really.
That Blackheart is, I mean, are you, you're Mormon, right,
I
Chad?
grew up Mormon.
But
Yes,
Mormon,
not
and
now.
how about you,
Please.
Anthony?
Oh, profound amount of Catholic damage. That's
Okay.
why, like, the your Daredevil run to me is just like so
Yeah, it's Catholic.
quintessential.
I mean, I was raised Catholic, catechism, you know, I got confirmed and all that stuff. And so I have like the deep Catholic stuff. And I think that the devil is interesting because it's you know, he there's this whole narrative when you're a kid about how he was kicked out of heaven for being a rebel. And there is like a at least 100 some year history of Lucifer being sort of wrongly viewed because, you know, the it's like, isn't it, what is the famous book? Milton, Paradise
Oh,
Lost.
Paradise Lost. I wrote my
Yeah.
dissertation about
You did?
it.
Oh, well, then let's
Yeah.
start there
Let's
because
jump in, yeah.
I think I read, like, back in the day, I probably read like the Cliff Notes of Paradise Lost. And I remember that. I don't, so you're gonna have to fill us in here because my memory is kind of like God's regime was like to a certain degree kind of authoritarianism.
Yeah,
And you can
exactly.
see it in the Bible. When you're a kid reading the Bible, if somebody doesn't believe in God, he smites in the whole town. You know, he burns the town down if you don't believe in him. And so, it's so in some ways, Lucifer. And I think I even don't. I think in those early stories, I even had a character named Lucy.
You sure did.
That was kind of like a Lucifer. That was like a androgynous,
Yeah, no
you know,
pants.
totally binary, no genitalia.
Yeah, exactly.
Lucy Lucifer. I mean, the stuff you could get away with back then, you know, it was I think about the 80s, we could really do whatever we wanted, you know, the stuff they would definitely cut out now. But the idea was Blackheart starts out angry and defiant of his father. And he doesn't start out evil, but that was supposed to, I think, if I can remember that long ago, I think it was supposed to echo the narrative of the Bible of the fallen angel defying the authoritarian God, becoming a symbol of rebellion and revolution, which I think Paradise Lost gets into that, right? And I remember this all coming back when I was teaching film in Haiti, the Black Jacobean book about the original rebellion of Haiti was there's some like tangle of stuff there that I'm trying to dig out of my memory. So talk to us maybe about Paradise Lost. Did you
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's so funny because that's so. Before I started working on Blackheart, I knew I wanted a character like this, and I've always been obsessed with him. And, he's been sort of like huge in popular culture. Like, he was in the movies and he was in the video games I grew up with. And I hadn't reread the original stuff. And when you go back to that Daredevil 270, like, everything you just said is right there. Like, it's an interesting transformation of Mephisto too. Like, he suddenly looks different in the Romita art, but also, like, yeah, it is sort of this ancien regime. He has a kind of You really lean into like the medieval punishment of hell, and Blackheart looks at this and is like, "This is so tired. I don't understand why you want to rule this way." And Mephisto keeps telling him like, "You're my son, and this is how we do things." And you do this amazing thing where he's like autochthonous, like he just sort of emerges from the like ground of Christ's crown. He's sort of born evil in a way that Mephisto at least sometimes seems like he isn't. Like there's dialogue that seems to imply Mephisto was once an angel, even though this has been retconned and re-retconned so many times. But like you are thinking about the Paradise Lost thing, and I love the idea of what if a demon rebelled against Satan, for the same reason Satan rebelled. Because
Exactly. So it's kind of a couple hundred years old, I guess. I mean, in terms of Paradise Lost was written, what, 18?
1667. It's
Oh my
pretty, yeah,
God.
it's pretty far
Wow.
back, yeah. But it's so ahead of its time that it does become sort of the rallying cry of the romantics in like the 18th century, the early 19th century. Like William Blake talks about how like Milton was of the devil's party and didn't know it. So there is a kind of like way Paradise Lost kind of creates Byron and Shelley and Blake. Like there is something really avant-garde about this sort of imagining of like, what if the devil was a hero?
And what's funny, because when I was rereading those stories, which I didn't really have much of a memory of, I think I know what I'm doing. I'm trying to say that, and I think I must have talked about this with John Romita Jr., because I remember we were talking about how Mephisto in the Marvel Universe was just a guy in red spandex, you know. And we were like, and Johnny was like, if I'm going to do Mephisto, let's give him more gravitas and more reach. And I'm pretty sure Johnny came up with the idea that he would have his fingers and everything, and so therefore his body literally would have these tendrils going everywhere. So
Oh, that's so
the idea,
cool.
yeah, and the tendrils going everywhere was literally Johnny, because Johnny's also a lapsed Catholic, or maybe even not a lapsed Catholic, probably still a Catholic. And then the idea that Blackheart noticed that his father's methods were kind of archaic and dorky, you know, like he, it's almost like the stuff you hear when a major musical movement gets usurped by another one, like, you know, then rock and roll hits, and then punk hits, and then the rhythms, the previous rhythms are absorbed into the new rhythms, but they're also kind of like the old rhythms kind of lose some of their power. And so the Blackheart's thing, from what I could tell, from what I was trying to do in those, is that it's very modern in that it's about gossip and bickering. Like they're always bickering. And at first I was like, why is everyone bickering in this comic? And then I went, oh yeah, that's right. Blackheart's making them all turn against each other and bicker. And I think Johnny and I carried that on, especially the brother against brother in the, I don't know, Karnak and Gorgon aren't
Right,
really,
yes. Their
but
huge naked fight, yeah.
a huge naked fight. Yeah. And honestly, I also think that at that time, the Inhumans were given to us as nobody's doing anything with the Inhumans. You can use them. Use them. I don't remember how much of a command it was, but it was kind of like, you can't use them. You know how it is. You work at Marvel now. If somebody's off in another dimension or another realm, you can't touch them. Or characters are overused, because I was the
Right.
editor of the X-Men at the time, and everybody wanted more Wolverine in every book. I mean, if I had said yes to every Wolverine guest star, he would have been in every book, because it's partly an understanding of back then, if a book's sales were dropping, but everyone really liked the book, you would loan them an X-Men so that the sales go up. But it was because you want to draw attention to a good book. You don't want it to die
Yeah,
because
yeah.
sales are dropping. So you want to give it a little, you know. So I think at the time, Ralph or somebody, my editor, Ralph Macchio, somebody said use the Inhumans. So I didn't even know really much about them, you know.
So let me toss a little bit of an introduction. Now, last October on the show, anybody can go listen. We did the Trial of Mephisto, and it was really fun because I got to do a deep dive not only into my own weird origins, but into the history of this character. Mormonism has a weird view, but as we explored the concept of the devil and the way it existed in my life and in the way it exists in the comics, we had this kind of turn in the conversation during the academic panel where we realized the devil is the representation of capitalism. The threat, the sin is any individuality. That's what casts you out. If you refuse to play by the system or the rules are there to keep you present. And I shared a lot of my, again, my weird beliefs and upbringing and the way that the devil played a kind of a presence in my life. I'll toss this out here for the two of you. Let's follow up after. But Anthony, you should definitely send Annie a copy of Dayspring, your book. I think she would
I
love
would
it.
love
It's
to.
brilliant. So I want to toss out just a quick introduction to the character based on Annie's first introduction of Blackheart in Daredevil number 270. This is the only one we'll delve into. The rest of today's episode will be topical rather than specific. We often go appearance by appearance. Daredevil 270 came out in September 1989. In my opinion, one of the best single issues of all time. It truly is breathtakingly beautiful. I'm going to read some of the captions and just do a brief presentation. Go look at this issue. Go look at the art and the way it's structured. It's so gorgeous. In 1658, on a crown in a gent, excuse me, on the crown of a gentle hill, Abigail Houseman was brutally, irreverently murdered. Her blood soaked the land for many hours before she was found. In those hours, a funneling flock of crows circled the spot like a troubled tornado. Yes, they were just ordinary birds, but they knew something was horribly amiss. Over the next centuries, various crimes were committed on the same grassy crown. Children began to avoid the hill, and if in their play one chased a ball or kite into the spot, the child would freeze in fear, its little heart tap dancing faster and faster until finally dashing away. The grass on the crown began to deepen in color to a blue-green and finally a violet. Nearby houses could not keep owners nor tenants, and one by one were left deserted. Had something been created on this spot? Or was it just that humans began to regard the spot as evil? And in down so endowed it, excuse me, and in and in down so endowed it with false power. But no matter how, something had stirred, had shifted, and it was not good. The ground was soaked in blood, the air with screams, and pain seemed to fill even the plants that grew out of the hill. Strange plants, twisted with a melancholy beauty, romantic, tragic roses with a thousand thorns for every blossom. The anguished beauty of the place attracted the young and restless teenagers began to dare one another into nightly visits into the spot. They held seances or simply held their lovers in their arms, and eventually more tragedies were added to the hill. And then we shift to the present day. A woman named Sarah is attacked on the hill among the thorns there that have grown. The caption says Sarah screams, and as her screams are added to centuries of screams, some edge is topped, some critical mass is reached, something bubbles up, spills over. And a blast splits the ground apart, and Blackheart emerges. His design is shocking. He's a demon with a tail, with unkempt hair like his father Mephisto, his expression blank. He emerges fully grown, ebon black, like a spill of ink on a pink background. There is power, and yet it is as knotted and twisted as an ancient tree, as if the creature is in constant agony. His muscles twist like barbed wire, and if so much power could be only so, excuse me. And as if so much power could only be painful. His eyes burn red, tragic, hollow, dripping eyes that have never known sleep. There is a stench like that of a smoking, burning ink, yet it's mixed with the sweet scent of rose. Sarah looks in awe at the creature with an almost religious wonder and knows that this burning black ember was flung from the fires of Hades itself. And the black-hearted one turns to, excuse me, and the black-hearted one turns its blinding darkness on them to see who they are. The boy is doomed, that is clear, but it sees that the girl is special, is good. She knows who she is, and that makes him glad. He's happy, as when a puppy first recognizes its own name being spoken and feels he is the center of the world. The joy also shows Blackheart what he must do. He lashes out with a tendril, and the two humans wither away to husks. And the caption says, "Sacrifice, the ones that shine bright, that glow with goodness." And then Mephisto appears in a frightening new form. He's naked and pink, kind of an androgynous demon with almost like a horse-like face. His hair is looking like ripped paper shreds on a homemade doll. "Congratulations, my son, on your first kill." "Ha." "Crude, unimaginative kill, perhaps, but nonetheless, your first newborn steps." And not doing any differently, Blackheart then turns to his father, eager to kill again. What's this? You try to kill again so soon? A feisty child, an eager servant. There truly is a shadow cast over your heart. Go on, kill me. Feel triumph and then know its opposite. I am Mephisto. I am your father and your better. Look into your maker's eyes and know the torments beyond imagination that await you if you ever again forget your place. That's right. Feel the glorious surges of power, tingling along a spine, taut as a whip, and then fall with the sickening panic in those moments when your power drains away. You will become quite intimate with this pendulum of swinging feelings. Your own heart, dark heart, beats this pace for you. It is the pace that comes with reaching for godhood. But if you are an infant to the ways of evil, to merely kill, that is as common as man. Explore more sublime forms of evil. If you had lured that good woman into killing you, now that would have been victorious. Now relax and allow me to mold your visage. You must walk among men in this form, for the eyes of men diminish evil if too many see your true form. You lose power. Evil grows and flourishes when hidden and covert, dies when exposed and looked at. When exposed and looked at. And he reforms Blackheart into a more human-looking form for the first time. Blackheart fights Daredevil. He can smell his foe, Daredevil can. He's something burning, something foul, yet a hit of incense, rose, incense, and he can sense him. Humanoid, but not human. Radiates some kind of black power. Is it a mutant? Is it mysticism? Senses reeling, something making me sick. His energy, his stench, so revolting. Only a few times in my life have I felt this, and always when confronted with something completely evil. When Spider-Man arrives, he yells, "This guy stinks, like old rot with cheap perfume dumped on top." And Daredevil observes, no matter what we hit him with, he keeps coming. He's confused like an animal or a child, but too powerful to fool with, and powered by something irreparably dark. Irrepressibly dark. I can feel it in my gut, my soul. A Blackheart observes a crowd of panicked humans. It does look at the people. It has no true memory, and yet it feels some ancient knowledge. There are motions to go through, stances to take, postures with no meaning for him yet. It is what he must do. He must make a mockery of sacrifice. And then, after he gets punched by both heroes, the thing reels and remembers the words, "Avoid the eyes of man," and knows why it is weak and why the time is not right. And Mephisto's there watching the whole time. And we close with this scene. We move back to the hill, now bathed in darkness, and the caption says, "Christ's crown." A bristling, tortured Blackheart crumples on the hill, collapsing, melting, sinking into the ground. He cries out in anger to his absent father. Why was he brought forth? Why was he forced into this? Why was he forced into being in this, a dark, cruel world? He does not want this, his own birth. He does not want to live, just to suffer, to die. He joins the briars, the thistles, the roses and thorns of this earth and hopes his father will forget him and let him rest in peace. And that is a fucking story.
Definitely written by somebody who spent too much time in church. That childhood, the way religion seeps into your brain as a child, you know, and all those tortured stories. I'm old enough to, I think the masses were in Latin back then.
Wow.
When
yeah.
I did, yeah. So it was extra, extra tortured. But I do remember this kicked in a memory of when I was a kid. We did have, I don't know if either of you have any of this kind of memory, but we lived by a forest, and I remember there were a few spots in the woods that terrified us. And one of them had a bad history. It was a bad kid that used to like skin animals and then like nail their hides to trees and stuff. So when we were kids, we would get up close to this sort of killing ground and, you know, you'd step in and you'd scream and run away. It's that instinct kids have for like a bad spot on the planet. And I think I just folded that into this story, this childhood fear we had of this, you know, patch of rough forest where bad things happened, you
It's
know.
ironic recording this now. I wrote these notes weeks ago, but over the Christmas break, my husband and I watched Yellow Jackets, which is very this. It's these girls in the woods, and there's an entity, and there's this question of did their insanity create it or is it with them? We also just saw Nosferatu yesterday, and the
Oh,
idea of like
sure.
the cursed land and the evil being and the rules that that has to operate by. I think it's fascinating the way we capture this in fiction. Anthony, oh, so Annie, please.
I mean, I think it's also, it is Christ's crown. You know, the ambiguity of the father betraying the son. He's got the crown of thorns, and I don't know where the roses came from, but probably, you know, they go along with thorns. Well, you
Yeah,
know.
I'm really curious about that because like the idea that he smells kind of bad but kind of nice is really fascinating to me and like such a fascinating choice.
Well, yeah, it's being drawn to evil, and I mean, I guess the master of this stuff would be Stephen King, you know, kind of like, I love how King will make like the dog evil, you know, or the car. Like he'll find something incredibly mundane. He has that great book that's all about the ice cream man, you know, the ice cream man is the evil in the whole book. I think there's even a comic made of it, right? Or the ice cream man, it's like the evil, because you take something that seems to move through so sweetly with the bells and the here's some ice cream, and Stephen King turned that into a villain. And so I forget where I'm going with this.
I
I was just
think
thinking
you're
about the aesthetics of him, like,
I think you're picking up on a lot of different tropes. Anthony, you love a character that stinks.
I mean, it's funny listening to that. Like, you just don't get prose like that in comics anymore. Like, this is
Feels
one
a
of
little
Annie's.
urgent to me
But
now.
that's what I like. Like, I think that prose in a comic should be kind of radioactive purple prose. Like, I like the idea that the writer is painting in the same vivid colors that the artists are. And the way that you can do, like, what's great about this issue, which is sort of amazing as a one shot, is like it just feels like a tone poem. Like it's so, as much as it's thinking about the evil of Blackheart, it is so like elegiac. It's so mournful about the state of him. One thing I always wonder when I read this is like, did you always know you were going to bring him back? Did you always know this was like the launch of a new character? Because like the ending leaves it closed that we may never see him again.
Yeah, and I think that when I first started writing Daredevil, and I think maybe Chad and I talked about this, it was I kind of avoided the hero, and my run opens with a lot of like sort of one shots or two issues about villain, 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 villain. And I think Ralph at some point said, you know, Annie, you're gonna have to deal with the hero, you know, because the hero, once you start dealing with the hero, that's when you have to really do like the deep thought. So he was possibly, obviously, because Daredevil dress, he's a lapsed Catholic. His mother wasn't his mother a nun, right? Didn't it? Maggie turned out to be his mom. And you know, so he dresses like the devil. So it's an obvious thing. I mean, I'm assuming there were Daredevil and the devil stories before my run. I'm assuming, but maybe
There's
not. I don't.
a story I tell in my memoir, which is being adapted to a graphic novel as we speak. I'm very excited about its release. Where after I came out, I went to a therapy session where my therapist asked me about my childhood hero, which was a funny question. And the person I brought up is probably someone neither of you have heard of because it was a Book of Mormon character, not a Bible character. But it was a guy named Abinadi who was this old man that God sent into this like wicked town to like prophesy, which is like very Noah before the flood, right? And this guy Abinadi ends up getting like burned at the stake, and as he's dying, he's like, "If my sacrifice changes one person, then that's worth it." And it does; it converts one person who goes on to help other people. And I told that story to my therapist, who looked at me and he goes, "That was your childhood hero, because that's really fucked up." And when I
Yeah,
reread, well, when I reread this Blackheart story, there's these moments where he recognizes, "Oh, these humans have to sacrifice." He makes a mockery of sacrifice, is like this word that you use, which leads me to think like Mephisto and Blackheart are created the way they were created. Kieran Gillen picks up on this with Mephisto later. Like, this is how I was created. I have no other choice. I had to have a child and I had to play these games with him almost because that's what God did with his kid. And I have no other choice but to reenact that. It's a really fascinating idea, and you hit it from every angle in this one issue.
And I think that what happens is Anthony knows when you do a story, you kind of back then we used to get letters because there was no internet. It's called the internet didn't exist, so the letters would come in and you'd get a bunch of letters of people saying, "Blackheart's cool, bring him back." And then you say, "Ralph, what do you think?" And then you say, "Johnny, you want to keep drawing him?" And so that's kind of how it works. It's like if the fans didn't react, and if Johnny didn't want to draw him again, it probably wouldn't have happened. But Johnny was really into him, and I was sort of struck by like this weird idea of literally the bickering. The bickering is just, the idea that the devil could be somebody who enters a room and just starts making people bicker, and that's kind of the state of the world right now. You could say that people taking one side or the other and going at it is basically like as about as devilish as,
Yeah.
it's sort of like that's what is Twitter if not people like
I hadn't thought of that. Blackheart should get really into Twitter. That sounds like a good idea. I mean, that's why I wanted him actually, is I have this cast of characters who I really like and who really like each other, and I was like, I love this friendship and I love how complicated their relationships are, but what I wanted was like a Seven of Nine. I wanted someone who could drop into a scene and everybody kind of hates them and they don't care. Like
Before I forget to say, I loved your Blackheart stories. I mean, not just as Blackheart stories, but they flow so beautifully. They're really, really great stories. I read everything Chad sent me.
every
Oh
issue of
my
Avengers Academy is gorgeous and brilliant. I love a book that makes me slow down and appreciate every moment. I love it. It's so good, Anthony.
God. And the way
Thank
the
you.
artist has he really uses the inky tendrils of Blackheart so beautifully. Like you really just feel like now where's he sticking his fingers?
Yeah, right. I wish I had known. I'm so glad to know that's what you guys were thinking, 'cause like yeah, the art we've been getting. I mean, Bailey Rosenlund in that confession issue just like blew us away. Like, and it's weird because we're sort of inventing this kind of newish way to write a comic, right? Like, we don't have page turns, we're just scrolling endlessly. And like thinking about the way you can expand a margin so that the margin itself becomes art, which is what something we kind of did with the M Plate arc too, and now that Blackheart issue, it's just like, what if the margin is just like a statue of the Virgin of Mary or the tracery of the cathedral? Like, but all of that comes straight out of your work. Like, it's
And that
so.
I
Sorry.
kept thinking about this thing that's this vertical comic that you scroll through. It was really fun to read,
Oh,
but of
thank you.
course, being like somebody who's a paper person, an old school person, I kept saying, "Well, now I want to buy the comic," but there is a comic.
No,
Like,
it's
and you
true.
realize the way they're designed, you couldn't just make a comic of it.
It would be tricky. Yeah, it is a problem we're kind of coming up against now.
You'd have to figure out. And the whole idea of panel borders, like, I mean, the first, of course, it goes way, way, way back. I think Winsor McCay used to do stuff like that with making the panel borders have a artistic thing. But then I think it became really apparent with what was his name? J.H. Williams, right? He was doing he was doing Batwoman, maybe, and it was like these glorious pages. And then I got to work with Trevor McCarthy on Clarion, which was a Kirby character, and he was heavily influenced by J.H. Williams, and so we literally made the panel borders in every issue, made them a big thing, like. If it was techno, there was like a little viral nanobot insect kind of thing. And if there was a girl Rapunzel, forget her name really, but she was based on Rapunzel. And so all the panel borders were her endlessly long hair. And it's that stuff, it's so perfect for Blackheart because he's everywhere and nowhere.
As
So
you're describing that, I'm also realizing, I don't know when Venom was created, but it's very Venom or Carnagey, right? Like the symbiote oozing into things and taking it over. That's an interesting realization because I think they probably debuted around the same time.
and you get the same thing with Warlock a lot. Like there was a
yeah,
lot
Warlock.
of the Warlock stuff. Art Adams especially really loves to like have this frame structured by this sort of entity that is, again, like his tendrils kind of get everywhere, right? Like he's sort of the
Yes.
seepiness of his body is part of the character.
I guess that was like there was a moment when I sometimes I think of comic art, there are like the simplifiers and the complicators. So you have like I love like Alex Toth's sensibility of just a very, very simple graphic storytelling. But then there was the rise of the complicators, you know,
Sure, Chris Bocciolo.
where a Spider-Man wouldn't just have a web shot, it would be like thousands of lines, you know. And, you know, and that was art too. That was Arthur Adams. You know, he did the first like ornate web shot that then McFarlane went, you know.
Well, it's funny reading this issue, like so much. I think like a lot of the McFarlane demons come straight out of this issue, really. Like Romita kind of creates that kind of horse-headed demon that will then dominate the Image line. Like Violator and all of that comes straight out of this Blackheart issue and the way Mephisto suddenly gets an update for the 90s, right?
No, and I think it's, you know, it's evil is something that we have to deal with. I mean, you know, it's sort of like villains who just want to kill. And I think that's what Mephisto says. He said, "Yay, you're a baby. You took your first baby steps. You killed somebody. But if you had seduced the good girl into being bad, that would have been a bigger win." You know, and that is that the devil finds turning a good person bad as like that is like the height of his art.
Do you
You know?
have do you have thoughts about Abigail Houseman? Like I've been kind of thinking about her a lot lately. This sort
Oh,
of character who's
you can please do whatever you want with her. I mean, I think
okay.
it really does come out of that thing when I was a kid, and so there the kid was skinning animals, and I actually got in a rock fight with him when I was a kid. We used to do rock fights, which is so stupid. We'd throw rocks at each other, and I have all these scars on the side of my eye from when a rock hit me. And we just decided that this was an evil spot, and that's where that all came from. And it was also, I imagine, some kind of fear. What else did that kid do?
Which is
The
very American horror story. It's the idea of these cursed places where the ghosts get trapped and the evil exists. Now, I want to cover a couple things quickly, and then I want to hear both of your comments on this. If you guys would like to follow the comprehensive journey of Blackheart, I not only wrote this guy for the appendix and for the handbooks, but you can go to the Marvel Universe appendix and click on the Blackheart profile written by me, and it's a comprehensive exploration, up to date, up to Avengers Academy, with all of Blackheart's experiences, encyclopedia style, so feel free to go through. But there's basically three kinds of Blackheart stories. He's never been one of the focal characters until, except with Annie at the beginning and Anthony now, but he's a frequent villain used. But the first type, we often get him as kind of the tempter of souls, the demon that whispers in your ear, tries to turn you evil, right? He wants to give you the trolley problem and force you into making the Faustian bargain or corrupt your innocence. But it has to be your choice each time. And the end result is the altered time or the character resurrected or the person given superpowers. It's Mephisto, but Mephisto Jr. instead, right? Like it's the guy trying to spite his dad, which brings us to the second story type, which is Blackheart as the son of Mephisto. There's a lot of stories of him fighting with his dad, trying to overthrow his dad, trying to get power away from his dad. He wants to control his own realm of hell. Occasionally he'll serve his dad, but often it's just animosity, which is very like Odin with Thor or Zeus with Hercules, those types of relationships. And then that's the third type of story we see often with Blackheart, started by Annie, but never really picked up on consistently. And that's the idea of Blackheart being banished. There's a story referenced once in the Falcon series where he was sentenced to 1,000 years in a lower realm of hell with no power, you know, and time works different in hell, so whatever. In Daredevil 180, excuse me, 282 by Annie, though, is the first time he's banished to Earth and given a human form. And Mephisto transforms him in that very first appearance as well, but it's quickly forgotten. There's a series called Ghost Rider Wolverine Punisher, Hearts of Darkness, where he's banished to Earth and given a human form again, and he has to depend on like worshippers for power. In Venom Volume 2, Blackheart is banished to Earth again and given a human form called Mr. Degly. And now we have the more recent story in Avengers Academy where he's banished and given this more vulnerable, kind of heartfelt human form. At least we hope, the one that seems more keen on redemption. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on those types of stories. And Anthony, I would love to hear, especially your choice to bring Blackheart in. It sounds like this is a character you've thought about for a long time.
Yeah, I as with Annie, grew up very Catholic, and the thing that appealed to me, and she was getting at this about the Daredevil stuff, the thing that appeals to me is he kind of has a different origin than most demon characters, in that he is not born good. He is born bad, which is actually the very Catholic sense of what it means
Yeah,
to be born, right? Like
original sin,
originally.
yeah, we're like doomed, you know, the
Yeah.
black, and when you're growing up and they're like, yes, you're born with original sin, a little black mark on your soul, and every time you lie, your soul is turning black. I mean, that's basically, you know, that I got that in spades as a kid, you know.
Me too, like that,
Yeah.
and in a book that is so much thinking about, I mean, it really has sort of several structural ideas, but like one of them, the main one, is what does it mean to be a hero? Am I born bad? Like, these are questions that a lot of the characters sort of struggle with. Like, we have Normie Osborn, who is the heir to the Osborn legacy and the Green Goblin stuff and all the symbiote stuff. We have Kid Juggernaut, who is like our nicest character, but his legacy is like you are in service to a demon. You are the rage personified. So, I wanted a character that could get at all that and like. Obviously, like Brielle Brooks is a half part vampire, right? But also the queer characters, right? Like Sheila has to ask this about herself because she's trans, and like that is a very common queer experience of like, I guess I'm just bad. My parents say I'm bad. And Blackheart is like the ultimate version of that. He's literally a few seconds old before he's told, you are Blackhearted, you are this demonic thing, and your job is to be bad. And so that's why. But what I love about that first story is like it is already thinking about him being incarnated. Like I was very aware when I picked him that he had been sentenced to be human before, but nobody picked up the ball. Like it always partly because his visual is so tempting, right? Like
You
he's
know,
such a great design.
the weird thoughts I was having rereading a story that I had totally forgotten was, well, one thought was like, Lucy is obviously a trans Lucifer. And I wondered why a Beastie Boys shirt. I think that must have been John J.R. Like, I was like, what was I thinking with the Beastie Boys shirt? And then I'm like, I have no idea.
Well,
Because
and fast forward to another infamous issue where Mephisto goes to the bar on Christmas Eve and poses as a woman and makes out with Daredevil for a
makes out
while,
terrible, yeah.
which is
That was
very
the
Bugs
best.
Bunny.
Yeah. And it's sort of the other thing, oh, and then I had your thought, like, when by the time I got, I was like, why is Silver Surfer suddenly in this series? Because I can't remember why. But then I thought it could be because when he was no longer the Herald of Galactus, he was exiled to constantly just spin around Earth and can't go home and can't. I have a feeling that there was some conscious thought of a parallel there
Well,
that
Annie, let me interject
Blackheart.
quickly. Mephisto first shows up in Silver Surfer. He sees the Silver Surfer in his initial appearances as by Stan Lee as like the most pure, innocent soul, the one that he needs to corrupt more than any other. He's obsessed. I kind of thought there was a through line of you bringing him back there.
There could be, but also, you know, Ralph Macchio was my editor, and Ralph is, you know, he's a comics historian, and he might have decided, hey, bring Silver Surfer in. Like, I'm not really sure. I no longer know. Could have been Johnny. I want to draw Silver Surfer, but I felt like if it was a happy accident or conscious or not, there is that parallel of being exiled, from your kingdom, and it's very biblical.
Yeah, and like the Silver Surfer is also like Blackheart in that he is a person who is serving this evil entity and then has to decide, I actually don't want to do this. And like, what does it mean? Is there a path to redemption for a character who is like orchestrated the destruction of worlds? Like the idea that Silver Surfer is a good person is such an odd idea given how many people he has helped kill. And he is kind of the child of Galactus in that way, right?
It's funny because I just got to be part of this. Marvel's doing this great series of giving Galactus new heralds. So I got to do Rogue.
Oh, and our dear friend Josh Trujillo got to do Gambit. What a fun pair.
I know I want to yeah, I'm waiting. I hope they collect them all so I can read them all, but it really is like Galactus is an interesting character because he has to do what he does in order for to keep cosmic balance. Like he serves a purpose that is seems on the surface from our puny little minds to be evil, but it isn't. It's something that he just has to do. And I have Rogue, of course, completely defying him, and then he breaks her, he has to break her into taking the job. So yeah, so I was thinking a lot about that kind of entity. Marvel has entities that are not necessarily evil because they perform a cosmic, whether it's Thanos is the same way, and Death.
Yeah, I'm interested in these sort of texts where the supernatural is just part of the everyday of the universe for these characters.
Between client meetings, managing your business, and everyday tasks, who has time to worry about website hosting? With Kinsta's managed WordPress hosting, you don't have to. They handle the technical stuff, delivering lightning-fast load times, enterprise-grade security, and 24/7, 365 human-only support. Simply switching to Kinsta can make your site up to 200% faster. Kinsta's custom dashboard makes managing sites easy, with powerful features designed to save you time and effort. Plus, their free expert-led migrations ensure a smooth transition. Ready to see why Kinsta is trusted by thousands of businesses? Get your first month free at kinsta.com. That's KINSTA.com. Kinsta, simply better hosting.
Tired of all the bugs in your yard? Enjoy your backyard again with Cutter Backyard Ready to Spray Bug Control at Menards. It kills mosquitoes, fleas, ticks, and other insects fast, controlling them for up to 12 weeks. A 32-ounce ready-to-spray container covers up to 5,000 square feet and is on sale now through July 13th. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week.
Save big money at Menards.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
And yet, we never get a closer answer about, like, well, is there a God? Like the Marvel Universe, partly because editorial will not let you be like, here's God. But, like, there is a kind of way that I did this in the confession story where, like, Blackheart, for all his power, for all his sort of cosmic awareness, has no more proof of the existence of God than any of us because, like, he is part of the same ecology we are, where it's like, well, this feels like what my job is. And there's powers above me and below me, and I will operate as best I can within the infrastructure as I understand it. But I like the idea of shrinking his perspective down to the human in a very kind of Christ-like way and being like, well, now what? What is your ethos now? what do you think about what you've done and what you're supposed to do now? And it seemed like a question that is pregnant in the character's design from the very beginning, even in that panel where Mephisto sort of remolds him into having a human face. And that I knew other people had done before, but I felt like there was never a story for him.
Well,
he always comes back.
Just to reflect, Lucifer's tossed out of heaven and Blackheart is tossed out of hell, right?
Right.
And I love the parallel.
No, yeah, that was very conscious. And so I hear what you're saying. Yeah, Blackheart, well, now you're giving him an actual arc. But I think that if I had stayed on the book, we might have brought him back. But, also, I like how Lucifer is... Or Mephisto, I mean, Mephisto is really impressed by people that can't be broken. Mm-hmm. And that's something about being a human that drives him kind of crazy. Like, I think Silver Surfer and Daredevil drive him a little crazy because you can't corrupt them.
Mm-hmm.
So, Anthony, give us give the listeners just a little bit of a peek into the story that you've told with Blackheart thus far in Avengers Academy.
So, one of the things I wanted to do was right before Christmas, we did a kind of Advent story where we saw Tommy and Billy Maximoff again. I keep checking in on those characters because they interest me a lot, but one of the parts of their origin story is that they are allegedly pieces of Mephisto's soul. So, again, I'm interested in characters who are like, well, am I bad because of the nature of my birth? And those two have it in spades, right? Like, they kind of, literally their origin is kind of this nightmarish possibility that they were pulled from this, like, demonic realm to exist to make the Scarlet Witch happy. And, like, I'm actually not convinced that is the case for them, but that's what they think, and that's what Mephisto thinks. And it gave me a chance to sort of think about their, like, quote, brother, Blackheart, who is also specifically is Mephisto's child. I used them as a kind of foil for Blackheart, as, like, he looks at these two innocent beings who have the same origin as him and wonders why they get to be good, which he knows implicitly. I think that's also a very Catholic experience of, like, you know, this other person you know is good, but you can't help but think of yourself as bad. So I wanted to sort of put him in sharp relief, and from that sharp relief be like, well, you're going to get a chance. And so he is incarnated by Mephisto as punishment and then sort of thrust into the space of the Avengers Academy and immediately starts causing trouble. He sort of purposely triggers Captain America's substance abuse problem as a way to sort of drive a wedge between him and Kid Juggernaut, but also to sort of think about his own existential crisis, which is why I wanted to spend some time with him in the confession story, just going to confession, seeming like he's talking to a priest, but actually looking for Daredevil and trying to triangulate who he is based on this person he knows as the person he wronged first and most, right? Now, from there, I want to think about, like, well, then what does it mean to be human? What does it mean to have these friendships? We're in the middle of a time travel story, and I'm sending him back to his origin. I want him to see what it is like to have been, who was Abigail Houseman? What was her situation? Mm-hmm. How did all this start? And what does his origin say
Wasn't
about
it Salem? Didn't I stick it with the witches?
Yeah, she's kind of a healer, is what it says. And, like, Christ's crown, she lives there. She must, because she dies there. So, but yeah, there is kind of, again, like, I want.
Thing. It might have been didn't I put it in Salem? I think just sort of cavalierly without any thought. Just thought, you know, because you think of, you know, there's this phrase, this one of my friends calls it necrotourism, where people go to death spots. And there's a long history of people going to a place where there were a lot of killings, be it mm-hmm. a Native American genocide spot or now, of course, genocide everywhere. But it's this idea that you go to the place where tons of evil happened and look at it in awe and fear and whatever. And I think that that was the childhood thing that me and my friends had with this spot in the woods where we knew bad things were happening, but we were too young to know why. And I remember I had this horrible, I was reading an article about a serial killer, and it turns out he would have been the exact age as, and lived in the exact town where this kid lived, who was skinning animals and nailing them to trees. And I thought, I wonder if that was the kid, you know, that kid, because it's the right age in the right town. I thought maybe he, that kid I knew, grew up to be a horrible serial killer.
The the Blackheart origin, it's women that are labeled as being killed. It's children that can sense the evil, right? But the interesting piece in tying it to Salem is here's a community that has licensed a group of men to hunt down women that it has deemed unquote evil. And here's where the roses grow, you know? It's a really fascinating thought experiment.
Yeah, and like the idea, I mean, it's something Annie has been talking about throughout, but like the idea that this evil place is called Christ's Crown. Like when I called him the demon of Christ's Crown, we got an editorial note of like, I don't know if we can do that. And I was like, that's the place's name. That's not, he's not the demon of the hat.
We've only had S&P, you know, we have the standards and practices at Marvel. We've only had it for a couple of years. And I remember when the first time I got the S&P feedback, that's a learning curve for them, because I think it's good because they question everything, but sometimes they don't understand that it is just a comic and that it doesn't have to be, you know, like fact checked and triple fact checked and, you know.
Yeah, I definitely someday will tell the story about my S&P
not on
fights.
Air, No, I have a few of those, but they're getting much better now, you know.
But yeah, it is sort of, I mean, I do think it's important also. I always think of the Orson Welles thing of like, their job is their job and your job is your job. And like, you push and push until you lose, and you're going to lose some. But you're then again, he died penniless.
You know, what do you call it? Denny O'Neill, who was basically my mentor at Marvel when I was just a kid, pretty much. He used to use a phrase. I think it was like, you always put a yellow tie on a cat. And I was like, what are you talking about? And he goes, well, you always give something ridiculous so the editor can feel like they're doing their job by going, why would a cat have a yellow tie? And you go, oh my God, hey, an editor, let me take that yellow tie off that cat.
Oh, I love that. I'm gonna, Orson Welles did the same thing. He would always put in like, and now the orgy. And they were like, no orgy. And you'd be like,
no
okay,
orgy.
I'll lose the orgy, but I'm
the blow job
everything
on the
up.
Other page isn't so bad now, is it? I'm fascinated as well, and we won't spend time here a lot, but the way we write characters who are all powerful and we make them work by giving them some vulnerability, right? If you go to the Marvel Appendix site and you read through the powers section on Blackheart, that's the thing we had to do on the handbooks, is like, let's write down everything a character can do and how it changes and what it looks like and what are the rules. The character Claw, I like remember stressing about that for hours, writing up the power section, because, you know, it's human sound and like, what do you do with that? Because it's different in every appearance. Blackheart's limitations and the way that they are being written now versus the all-powerful corrupting, but only when he has your consent thing, right? Anthony, how are you setting the limitations on Blackheart's powers?
I mean, it's funny because we've been it's so easy when there's another Catholic in the room, because because I've written, like, my book Dayspring is about Jesus. Like, writing all powerful people in human bodies is kind of a familiar thing for me. And so he has kind of the same limitations. He can do whatever he needs to do, but he is limited by the fact that he still has all the limitations of a human. He needs his sleep, he needs his food. You can hurt him, his body is vulnerable. So in that sense, his limits, and I think this is true with most Marvel characters, like Wiccan is a similarly extremely powerful character. His limits are based on his point of view. Like, what does he want? What is he nervous about? As a person who also struggles with anxiety, I know that, like, sometimes I am most limited by the fact that my body has decided I have a limit. that is maybe not even true, but I'm going to be really worried about this thing for the next little bit. So anxious characters are easy. With Blackheart, it's the fact that he doesn't know what he wants that limits him. So yeah, he can cast a spell and do this or that, but he doesn't know where he wants to intervene, what he wants to accomplish. It does help that the Marvel Universe is also populated with demigods. Like, for the New Year's Eve issue, he was fighting toe-to-toe against all the wizards of the Marvel Universe. And, like, I wanted to show he is actually still that powerful, even as we move into, like, but he doesn't know who he is, and he doesn't know what he wants anymore. And when he's an antagonist, that's easy. Like, when he's trying to corrupt a soul, the goal is at this very minute, like, the difference between Matt Murdock's hope and despair is a really fun thing to play at. Now, he's limited by the fact that he doesn't know what he wants yet.
And it's, you know, it all, I think I've, in that series, I remember being surprised that that I mentioned Galahad and Lancelot. And that was like a thing, because back then we were all reading Once and Future King.
Uh-huh.
So it was like, that was like the book of the 80s, you know, that we were all reading. And it was the idea in there that if you're born good, it's no big to be good. But if you're born bad, it's a reach to be good. Mm-hmm. So that's the better story. That's the more powerful story. And it's also the other thing that I remembered when you mentioned Captain America, to a certain degree, like Captain America, his name is Captain America, but which aspect of America does he represent? Mm-hmm. Does he represent America when America is like a mess of a, you know, international interventions and toppling like democracies and putting in authoritarian, you know? And I did one story where Captain America got really mad at something America was doing. And I think that, you know, when you do Mephisto Blackheart stories, it's that it's the beauty of the amorphous thing of what is the face of evil? What is the modern face of evil?
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so yeah, they resonate, they're archetypes, but they resonate, and you can mess with them a lot, you know.
So yeah. For people who would like to follow this character, read Annie's initial run. The only other one that's really powerful, there's some good ones with Blackheart along the way, but there's a series called Ghost Rider Wolverine Punisher : Hearts of Darkness. It's a Howard Mackey, John Romita Jr. story. It goes back to Christ's Crown again. It's powerful, really interesting. And that's from 1991. Anthony, just to point out two moments that I find really impressive from your work with Blackheart, and I'm not going to reference the new confessional story yet because it's not out when I'm recording this.
I think it'll be out when you drop this, though.
Because it will, but I have chosen not to read it yet. You can, you can reference whatever you like, but I like getting it live. There's a moment where Escapade, who's a character I'm tremendously fond of, who is the trans girl, she changes...
Charlie Jane. Charlie Jane. Yeah.
Beloved, wonderful Charlie Jane Anders. Escapade changes places, quote unquote, with Blackheart and immediately finds sympathy for him, immediately senses the pain and the confusion of his existence. And then we've got Captain Marvel, Carol Danvers, who has kind of just learned to trust these kids. And there's a moment where the heroes at the big party are like, Blackheart, fucking fight him. And Carol's like, no, the kids have made a decision here and I'm going to stand by the kids. And we're giving the son of the devil a chance, guys. That's just how it is. I think these moments with these characters are so powerful, and I'm really loving how you play them off of each other. I adore it, really, truly.
Yeah, and also the thing about the trans thing, the original trans character that I wrote for Marvel back in the
Jane Drake, yeah.
She was an empath, so she feels the pain of others acutely. That was her, and she even physically manifests. When she's you know, empathizing with you, she starts to look like you. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting that the Escapade has a similar empathic narrative.
Al Ewing does another character in his Immortal Hulk run, a character named Charlene McGowan. who is a trans doctor, non-powered. There's a guy named Xemnu the Titan that's like corrupting everyone's souls. And the caption given about McGowan is she's like, I know myself so well. I had to fight myself so hard to like be who I am that you can't possibly corrupt me. She's the one incorruptible character. I
Interesting,
love
yeah.
these trans narratives. I love them.
But I love that the trans narrative from the Jessie Drake or whatever she was called, an escapade, is that they're empaths, that they're compassionate, you know, which is really nice.
Yeah, I think that I mean I didn't create Escapade, and like I think that part of what makes her so wonderful as a character to get to know secondhand now, like I think I'm the second person who's gotten a chance to write her in any great length, is
Well, and you're now her primary writer. You've done more with her than Charlie Jane has.
which is so strange to think about. But I do feel like I finished my PhD and then I worked at Glad Day Bookshop here in Toronto, which is like a queer event space for Toronto's queer community. And my experience is that very often queer people do have to manifest a great deal of compassion. And part of it is also a trauma response, right? Like part of it is just like, I am in danger. I must be very conscious of the feelings and emotions of others if I'm going to survive my normal human interactions, right? Like having now started therapy myself, it is kind of like a thing you do, right? Like I have to know exactly where my parents' emotions are to get through day to day.
Yeah.
But part of it is that just like as myself, sort of a whatever is lapsed, I don't even know the word, Catholic. There does come a moment in your life where you are like, well, I can't be as evil as they're saying I am because either you do fall victim to that and you do sort of descend into the despair of that, or you learn to realize you've been given a narrative that is not applicable. And so you have to develop your own incredibly strong sense of here's who I am and here's who other people are, stripped of all the garbage and the barnacles that we've been forced to accrue to ourselves. So it was important to me that it is Escapade who looks at Blackheart and says, you're not what the narrative inside your head
Yeah.
tells you you are.
Yeah,
That's why I wanted that.
that's
When I
kind of
played by your
that's
rules,
brilliant.
I was suffering. And when I
That's
left those
brilliant.
rules is when I was happy. That's my
I
life
love that.
story.
That's really truly brilliant. That is really a good angle on to have her see that in him, because I think it's a little bit from the very beginning, he didn't necessarily want to be daddy's little evil sidekick. You know, that's
Right.
pretty clear that he doesn't want to, you know, but he is like punk music hitting, you know, like whatever Mephisto's listens to, probably Wagner, right?
Are we gonna see Mephista or Jezebel, as she's sometimes called, the daughter of Mephisto? I
No,
mean,
a
I
little
think
family book.
I think that one of the interesting things is, I mean, we're budgeted for 66 issues. I'm on issue 40. How much room is left is kind of a question. One of the things, I mean, from the very beginning in that New Year's Eve issue, Blackheart says to Carol, like, why bother standing up for me? You know, I'm going to go back. You know, I'm going to be what I was before. And part of that is me recognizing at a meta level, it is hard to know if this will stick. It is hard to know if this is Blackheart's new status quo, because the temptation to evil is going to be strong in the metatext too, right? Like Marvel may
He doesn't
want their.
know.
What's that?
Blackheart himself doesn't know.
Exactly.
He has no idea. He is like a baby. The thing that I just thought, oh, I remember when I first got to Marvel and Louise Simonson used to say, you know, lapsed Catholics are perfect to write comics. She used to say, oh, you're a lapsed Catholic? You'll do fine in this business. You know? Get it. You get the metaphysics that you're up against. You get the early damage, you know, as we were talking about our souls are black, we're doomed, you know, the whole thing, the original sin. So we're ready. We're born ready. to write complicated superhero villains.
I mean, I definitely agree. It was fun to get a crack at Daredevil for that one shot, for sure. It's like, oh, I know this guy backwards and
Yeah.
forwards.
Oh yeah. Any lapsed Catholic, you can write Daredevil.
Yeah.
So.
But as far as this, I like the, I do, I mean, that's a narrative too, right? Like, I think that many queer ex-Catholics do have the sibling that stayed in the game, right? I think it's, I'm sure it's a Mormon experience too, of like, how do you relate to someone who thinks you fucked up by leaving?
Yeah.
My hope is that Blackheart, this sort of gives Blackheart an engine. I really didn't want to change anything about him. I just wanted to show, as I do with a lot of these characters, I just wanted to be like, here's what's neat about this character, and hopefully we can tell more stories down the road. But I wouldn't say no. I could write him forever, you know?
Yeah, I
So.
mean, it's sort of like you throw your toys in the sandbox, and that's the game of the
Yeah.
shared universe, is that anybody who picks up the toy, I mean, we used to say you can borrow this toy, but leave it the way you found it. But actually, if it's a great story and it alters the character, that's a good thing, you
Well, thank
know.
you for giving me this amazing toy to play with for
Oh,
now.
No, you can do whatever you want with them, that's for sure.
I'm gonna tell a quick weird story that I have never told on the show before. It's not one I think about often. It's 1998. I'm a Mormon missionary in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and boy, was that a wild time. And my companion and I get a call through like the 1-800 number on the television. There's a guy locally who would like to take the missionary discussions, which is always like, oh, good, we get to go teach somebody and get a baptism, and then maybe I'll be good enough to make myself straight. We taught this man who like met us in his kitchen, a nice fellow, always extremely well behaved. He basically told us up front, I am not interested in being converted to your religion, but your religion is noted as, at the time at least, extraordinary in like getting numbers, and like the growth rates are way up. So I want to take all of your discussions so that I can study them. And he would bring a tape recorder out and like record each one, which technically is against the rules. We didn't know it at the time. We met
Huh.
with him like 10 times. We taught him all of the lessons. We parted on good ways. And it was later, after my mission, when I looked him up. His name is Ed Stuyvesant. He's a former author who has like a series of books under the title Raised Catholic, Can You Tell? And I don't know whatever happened with that man, but that was my like interface with Catholicism. He came to church, he took us to his church. Very pleasant, lovely experience overall. But I was like, man, these are very different things. Because Mormons would always refer to Catholics as, there's a quote in the Book of Mormon that would talk about like, there's a vision where there's it says like a quote, like there's a great whore sitting upon the many waters,
Sure.
corrupting all of the people. And like that, they would say like in whispers, like that's the Catholic Church. Like they're our enemy. They're the ones that we have to fight against mostly. And like just an odd comparison, but ultimately we come from the very same place, right? Like really
Yeah.
interesting.
I think that one of the things I wanted Blackheart to be about, and one of the things I work on in my own work, and I think I see in Annie's work, is I think a lot of Catholics deal with the fact of like, this is all wrong. The things I've been taught are not true, but gosh, they're beautiful. Like, there is a way that like the aesthetics and the like the majesty of Catholicism has a draw of its own. And that I think is part of what, that's why I asked right away about the smell of Blackheart, right? Like this sort of incense and roses. There is a way that Catholicism to me is this kind of demonic incense and
Yes,
roses
not
smell.
yet, not yet since. Yeah, and it's also the pantheon of gods. When I was a kid, the pantheon was like Zeus and, you know, and all those gods. And then there was a period of time when people would talk about, oh, the pantheon of gods is being replaced by the pantheon of celebrity, you know, where people were worshiping celebrity more than, and they were kind of like usurping the old gods. So yeah, I think it's also like it echoes times we're in. All narratives echo the times we're in. And you know, I definitely write from a place of anxiety about fears I have. You know, you have a fear about what's coming. You know, as a kid that was raised you know, w raised in the days when we'd have to dive under our desks to hide from nuclear bombs, you know, the absurdity of that, you know. So you write, if you write from what you're afraid of, that's a good place to start for a narrative.
Last summer, I had the joy of spending a week in New York City. I had a moment with both of you, among others, that it really truly changed my life. I'm still kind of sitting with the impact of it months later. Anthony, I had a moment with you and your partner where you acknowledged me as a writer, and that sounds like such a silly thing, but it really just hit me in the deepest place. Annie, I had a moment with you at the party where we just got to talk about like people, and I'm like, this is my childhood hero, and I turn around and Bill Sienkiewicz is sitting on the other side. And I'm like, what the fuck is my life? And I walked home that night, like crying, like, what is happening? It really was a truly transformative. I'm sorry.
Your Mormon book is really great. I mean, the little excerpt you sent me, I really, really loved it.
I would
So,
be thrilled to send you a copy of the memoir if you would enjoy it. But we did get picked up. Graphic Mundi is going to be publishing us
oh, good.
this
Oh, hey,
year,
congrats.
which I'm
Oh,
thrilled about.
excellent.
Yeah, thank you so much. Yeah, what an honor to be here with you both. And what a fucking beautiful way to start 2025. This year is so full of doom and like rough energy. Like, we got to create joy wherever we can find it. And if that means hanging out with two fun friends talking about the devil, then that's what it means. I'm so happy to be here with you both. I'd love to hear any final thoughts or any questions you have for each other as we're wrapping up. And then, where can people find you online? What would you like to plug for January 2025? Let's go, Anthony, and then Annie.
Well, I mean, you could pick up Avengers Academy if you are interested in Blackheart. That's where he's at right now. And if you're interested in Catholic Damage, you should check out my book, Dayspring. And I just want to say again, thank you for having me, Chad. And Annie, this has been one of the great pleasures of my life. You were out there for a little queer kid who was reading these books and being like, wow, Spider-Man's hot. And wow, like this is, I also know what it's like to be the devil. And I'm so proud to be working in your tradition and with the characters you created, and I try to honor them every time I touch them. So thank you so
Oh,
much.
thank you. That's so sweet. Yeah.
And Annie.
What am I supposed to be saying?
Oh, just anything you want to plug, and where can people find you?
Oh, I mean, one of the things I like, I mean, in this podcast, and you leading me to Anthony's work is great because for me, it's almost like I've written enough stories, so I'm really excited to read the next wave of comics. I felt like that when I did the Storm series, and my editor sent me a bunch of, the, what is it called again? Krakoa, Krakow, Krakow.
Going, yeah.
And I love seeing the next wave of talent in the comic business. It's super exciting for me. So I always try to pick up anything new. So this is great to I discover your work because it flows so beautifully. It's so much fun to read. And I was actually very impressed because I have this weird thing, and it's probably a Catholic thing, that I always want people to get their money's worth. They're paying $4 for a comic. It has to be layered and dense, and they have to be profoundly moved, and you don't have to do all that in a comic. You can do just a little bit of it, And I think you created a really beautiful balance of big ideas, moving things, but the comic also kind of flows, lickety
Oh.
split. So you a reader doesn't even know they're learning.
Oh my gosh, thank you so much. That
Which is
means the
like.
world to me.
Okay, lastly, I'm Chad Anderson. I keep my social media private because I got kiddos. The two of you are welcome to follow me, of course. Everyone else can follow me, graymalkin_lane on Instagram, most prominently. We're doing some really special things on the show this year. We're opening the year up with a massive script reading of Giant Size X-Men number one. We're closing January with the academic panel for the month, which is simply titled About Krakoa. It's Jordan White, Leah Williams, Sarah Sentry, and Bob Quinn. We're talking about radioactive monsters and mutant homelands and everything in between. It's very special. Three of us cried at the end. Like, it's really powerful. I mean, get Leah and Jordan in a room and have them talk about their Krakoa
Oh,
and
they're
comic.
both super talented people. Oh my
Yeah,
God.
just amazing. It was a true joy. This has been such a tremendous honor. Thank you everybody for the ongoing support. Watch for, I don't remember, I'll do my plug later. I don't remember what it's coming in next. My brain's full. So thank you everybody so much. Thank you, Anthony. Thank you, Annie. We'll see you back here next time on the Grey Malkin Lane Patreon. And now stay tuned for some thoughts on fascism as a special guest and I talk about a Red Skull story and its modern applications. In 1939, Adolf Hitler issued this quote: "I have issued the command, and I'll take anybody who utters but one word of criticism executed by a firing squad, that our war aim does not consist in reaching certain lines, but in the physical destruction of the enemy. Accordingly, I have placed my death head formations in readiness for the present only in the East, with orders to send to death mercilessly and without compassion men, women, and children of Polish derivation and language." In 1941, Franklin Delano Roosevelt issued this quote: "In the future days, which we seek to make secure, we look forward to a world founded upon four essential human freedoms. The first is freedom of speech and expression everywhere in the world. The second is freedom of every person to worship God in his own way everywhere in the world. The third is freedom from want. The fourth is freedom from fear. That is no vision of a distant millennium. It is a definite basis for a kind of world attainable in our own time and generation." Let's jump to Tales of Suspense numbers 89 through 91. The cosmic cube has kept the Red Skull alive in his golden armor at the bottom of the ocean floor and helped him wash up on Seagull Isle, one of Hitler's secret islands left over from the war. And he lures Captain America there with a fake message claiming that Bucky is alive. Captain America is shocked to see his old foe back. "The Red Skull, it's you, you're alive." And the Red Skull says, "Of course, you witless star-spangled simpleton. I have merely been toying with you, paying you back in kind for the fate I nearly suffered due to your bumbling interference." After a fight with a swirly purple robot, Cap fights a fake Bucky, and then after trying to kill Cap with a series of death traps, the Red Skull in a little silver airship traps an entire square mile of New York City in a plastic bubble and then lifts it up into the atmosphere with everyone inside. Skull lets everyone live, but only if Cap agrees to admit on national news that he will serve the Skull for 24 full hours. The Skull laughs maniacally as they fly past the Statue of Liberty. The Skull forces Cap to reveal the location of a nuclear submarine. Then he runs a lie detector test to make sure that Cap's telling the truth. But Cap would never lie, not in the 60s at least. Knowing now that Cap would have to live with the shame of betraying his country, the Red Skull then went to the sub and used a little metal hat to take over the minds of his enemies. So Cap tricks the Skull into climbing on board the Dreadnought, and then he blows it up. And his last words: "It is my destiny to rule. I must be true to my destiny." And then Captain America turns to the reader and says, "I'm no more a hero than any man who fights for justice and freedom and brotherhood. So long as we cherish liberty, so long as the bitter weed of tyranny can never take root upon our shores, then all of us are heroes, and the dream which is America will long endure." Let me welcome my dear friend Ben Rabb back to the show to talk about this crazy story. Ben, hi, how are you?
Hi, Chad. Thanks for having me back, especially for this one.
Oof. This is a little mini episode. I'm asking everyone this. Are you a Red Skull fan?
I mean, I'm not particularly a fan of Nazis per se. However, as a personification of the evil that they embody, that Cap can punch on a regular basis, I'm all for that.
Is this a story you had read before?
No, it is not. I didn't realize this was a Stan Gilkane joint. I thought it was going to be I always assumed that the Tales of Suspense were, the Stan and Jack. No, I had never read this story. Actually, thinking about it, I haven't read a lot of Red Skull stories now that I come to think of it. This was certainly of a time and of a place.
Stacking these up front to back has been a wild journey, which people will hear when the episode comes out. This is Super Science Red Skull. He's just, carving out a chunk of New York and lifting it up in the sky. What are your thoughts on the Red Skull's motivations in this? This is a wild plot line.
I mean, I gotta start with the fact, listen, it's funny. It's in reading it, I very much felt the hand of the Marvel method of writing in the storytelling, because like early on, as he's sort of recounting how he almost lost the cosmic cube at the bottom of the ocean, and he went to get it, but forgot that he was wearing armor. It's like, so like it's
No,
just it's
the
really.
actual story just before this, he gets the cosmic cube, and the first thing he wishes for is a suit of golden armor. But then he gets knocked into the ocean, and the golden armor weighs him down to the bottom of
Right, right. But
the
the fact that like it's called out in his narrative of, But in my blind, unthinking panic, I forgot that I was wearing a suit of armor. It's like, okay. So this was, Dan must have laid out the plot. Gil Kane drew it. There was the golden armor was part of it. And Sam realized, oh shit, wait a minute. He's going to get weighed down by his armor if he's at the bottom of the ocean. Like, it's just the fact that he had to sort of, like, there's these little moments of bumblingness that you're like, you really undermine the villain. But, you know, this was interesting.
I love a campy villain plot. The Red Skull and his little airship, it's giving, like, very early 60s cartoons. Like, it's
very much so.
It's kind of fun in a ridiculous kind of way. But when I open the show with these quotes where Hitler's like, we must destroy everything. And like, if we just believe in decency, we can conquer it. Anything, and both of them feel infuriating. What's it like hearing those in the framework of this fucking story?
You know, but in a weird way, the characters sort of both embody that, right? Like, you got the Red Skull who wants nothing more than to just, you know, wantonly destroy, but it's all motivated by like ego and this like weird sense of like, I want people to perceive me as this, you know, superior being. And Cap's, you know, very much the flag waving, you know, optimist that you know, we come to love about him. And
I'm such a good person. I can't believe you're still alive.
Right. Although there's one moment where Red Skull refers to himself as, oh God, there was something I was like, you have a very, very generous opinion of yourself, sir. Like, I don't know.
He's not suffering in the ego department by any means.
No. But, you know, in light of the, like I said, like the quotes, like, I mean, it's funny how, because I think these characters are so set up as representative of, whether it's Cap being America embodied or the Red Skull being, you know, evil personified, that they do speak to these very, you know, polarized black and white ideas of good and evil without the nuance as an excuse to just sort of punch each other.
The opposing ideals, right? Human decency versus human evil. I love the Red Skull's fashion, though. The Red Skull is a mask, and he's got like this like white kerchief ascot, white gloves, and this like green tailored suit. He's very much like Donald Duck in this era. It's like a Nazi Donald Duck. It's a very weird.
Right. Well, and I often wonder, like, you know, again, obviously creators of Captain America and the Red Skull being Jewish, presenting this sort of, I want to say foppish, because it's not really foppish, but it is this cartoonish version of what evil is, and saying that he's representative of the Nazis that we fought in World War II to stop, right? And these guys are a fucking joke, you know, and should always be presented in such a way that there is something that you can always laugh at them about.
There's this odd kind of parallel, and it's all through the Red Skull's long, decades-long history, where I have to disguise my evil to look like what Americans value. So we see it first here, where the Red Skull has an agent dressed like Bucky to fight Cap. It's Nazism is in the teenage boy form. And then he has to have Cap turn to the cameras, you know, and say, yeah, I will do whatever the Red Skull says. There's this idea of kind of domination that seems almost more important to him than destruction and conquering. What are your thoughts on that ideal of Nazism veiled in the Americanism?
I mean, in today's day and age.
Welcome to my show.
The notion of Nazism as, you know, a version of authoritarianism where it's the will of an individual representative of the state dictating everything for the masses, and the masses sort of having to go along with it. I mean, it's very sadistic and twisted what he does to Cap. You know, also, he is playing on his sense of virtue. I mean, he's like, you know, you said for 24 hours you would obey me, you know, and you are a man of your word. You have to keep it. That's Cap's weakness. Like, that is the perception, is that integrity is a weakness that fascism can constantly exploit. I do feel like it's being borne out in the world we live in today.
Yeah. Cap gets some crazy moves in this. He gets drugged by the ship through the water for a while. It climbs a rope and then gets to like put his shield on the end of a like rope and swing it around and like hurl it through a window. There's some funny stuff. And then the Red Skull is like crazy super science, right? It's giant robots and airships and like nuclear submarines. How can I turn America against itself? You're quickly seeing the purpose of these conversations already as they're playing out one at a time. We open on Captain America in 91, where he's just standing kind of limbs akimbo, being buffeted by a bunch of white people who are sobbing and furious and calling him a traitor. And somehow that's the worst thing, which is the Red Skull's greatest joy. But we're now looking in 2025 as Nazism veiled as patriotism, like right on the surface in our own country. And it's a wild thing to consider how that's always been the baseline of evil in the Marvel Universe, but here we are experiencing it in real.
Well, again, I mean, these, you know, like I said, the guys that, you know, Stan and Jack both served during World War II at a time when this was a legitimate real threat that was not just, you know, a danger to Europe and the world, you know, it was to them as Jews and the Jewish people. And like, so, you know, there was no greater evil. There was no, you know, greater sense of the worst fucking thing that could happen, and how we've gotten to a point now where the people in charge don't necessarily see things that way, and that strategically they see value in any of the ethos or the machinations of what was the greatest evil of the 20th century as a means to an end of their own choosing is incredibly disheartening. I mean, again, I can't imagine the generation that fought in that war that might still be alive and is seeing the kinds of things. I also can't, you know, believe the generation that fought in that war and is still alive and is supporting those things. I mean, it speaks to either a willful ignorance or an inherent prejudice or easily manipulated minds that basically succumb to whatever they're told through whatever source of media they're following, whether it's Truth Social or Twitter or wherever the fuck they're getting their news from, Fox News or, I don't know.
And the easily manipulated minds is where the story culminates, right? The Red Skull puts on a little hat and hypnotizes. We get a little funny view of like Captain America wearing a sailor cap to try to fit in with the guy, even though he's got a
I thought, I
mask
was like, do you really think you're not going to get noticed?
on. But then, as the Red Skull's ship starts to malfunction, we know Cap's decent because he still tries to save him. Skull, this is Captain America. You're in deadly danger. You have 60 seconds to exit. Abandon the ship now. We'll pick you up. Hurry. Let him blow up, man.
Right. I know it's very weird. Like that's the hero part of Cap, not the soldier part of Cap. I feel like the soldier part of Cap would be like, fuck that guy. He's going down with the ship and the world's going to be a better place for it. But, you know, again, like, and it's as a kid growing up, maybe not reading this particular story, but certainly other Captain America comics, you know, there was just something honest and sincere, and I don't want to say pure because I feel like that word is not the best word to describe anyone. No one is 100% pure, but there was a kind of purity to Captain America and what he was meant to represent, the best of the, you know, the strongest of the most daring, the bravest, the most compassionate, right? Like there was a side to him that a hero is compassionate, and Cap was always the embodiment of that. And
The
so
promoted values as they existed in this time period. Absolutely. But it's right before civil rights and Stonewall and everything blows up.
right.
We're going to track the Red Skull stories through that because
Oh, shit.
it gets
Okay.
real crazy.
Even to his enemy, there is compassion. Even to his, like, which, you know, in this day and age feels like an impossible thing to conceive of. It's very hard to have compassion for your enemies because they are doing ill to you. So wouldn't you want to do it back to them?
Right. In this story, again, it's very playful and silly, but the Red Skull saying, I will kill a million people unless you submit because I want to destroy you. And then Cap's like, yeah, but I still believe that there's good in you, buddy. Like, I don't know. It takes a little too far for me. Do you have any final thoughts? Were there any moments in this story that really stood out to you or anything you wanted to illuminate?
No, I mean, like I said, it was the campiness of it that I was like, man, this is really of a time and a place, you know, like, and it throws everything but the kitchen sink at him, where it's like it is robots, it is, you know, duplicates, it is a city being, you know, lifted up like in a giant plastic bubble. And by the way, unbreakable plastic. I was like, come on, Cap, seriously?
And just when you think he's dead, it's a reality-altering cube that keeps him alive again and again and again. Exhausting. Well, thank you, Ben Rab, for joining me for this little vignette. You are a talented and a fantastic ally and much appreciated. I appreciate it, my friend.
I appreciate the affirmation. Thank you very much.
Okay, everybody, stay tuned. We'll be right back.